Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and this is the podcast for people who'd like to be outside, but for reasons we're all far too familiar with, are indoors. My guest today, I'm not sure whether he's a climber or a cyclist or both, really. I don't really know. But I'm going to talk to Ollie Warlaw, who has completed classic climbs by bike. That sounds interesting enough, doesn't it? Hello, Ollie. How are you doing?
Hi there. Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. Where are you talking to me from, by the way?
I'm talking to you from Edinburgh today.
Oh, not that far away. Oh, right. Okay. So you're in God's country anyway.
I guess great. So. Yeah.
Or whoever created it, I don't know. So you're obviously a cyclist and a climber. And tell me about the idea for this epic sort of bike ride and climb. Where did it come from?
So where does it come from? So there is quite a clear place where it comes from. It wasn't my idea. So that's to start with.
Okay.
Because I'm not actually the first person to have done this. I'm the second.
Oh, wow.
I know I don't particularly sound like it, but I am actually brought up in Edinburgh.
Right.
Although originally from down in England. And back when I was younger, we had a family friend, family friends of ours, and one of their sons was at Edinburgh University, a guy called Jamie Fisher, and he got a bit, you know, earned a bit of extra money as a student, kind of childminding me and my older brother and sister.
Right.
And he was a very talented rock climber, you know, went away on expeditions to the Himalaya and such places.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so he was this kind of larger than life character to me as a kind of, you know, very kind of young child just getting into kind of outdoors. And he actually took me on my first kind of outdoor rock climbing experiences, which was just in the quarry on the back of Blackford Hill, actually.
Oh, wow. How old would you have been about then?
Oh, it must have been, I don't know, 10, 11, something like that. I think end of primary school.
Right. Okay.
Anyway, so this guy, Jamie, you know, very into climbing and expeditions. And one summer in 1997, he decided that he wanted to complete all of these climbs in this book, Classic Rock, which is it's a coffee table book, really.
Yeah.
Kind of produced in the 70s, which is 80, I always get mixed up, 82 or 83 climbs now. 83 climbs all around the UK from the kind of tip of Cornwall up to the Isle of Skye. And they're not necessarily the best climbs in the UK, but they're kind of climbs of their era. So often they're the kind of classic ones on particular mountains or rock faces. You know, or maybe some of the very first ones done. So not necessarily the hardest or the best, but routes with a lot of history to them.
Yeah, routes that kind of stand out as being markers for an era. Is that really what they were?
Yeah, I guess so. Although again, it was at the whim of this guy Ken Wilson, who compiled the book. So, you know, it's been debated for the last kind of 50 years about what routes should really be in there.
Yeah, I actually met Ken Wilson at a party in Sheffield once, and. Okay. I'll just put it this way. I overbalanced and fell on his harmonium. He wasn't too impressed. But anyway, that's an aside. Right.
So Jamie decided he was going to do all these climbs. But, you know, that was a bit easy because they're not actually the hardest climbs out there. Often they are. Well, yeah, they were hard at the time. With current kind of climbing equipment, you know, they're kind of within most people's kind of ability range.
Sure.
So he decided he was going to cycle between them all. So he started from Cornwall and cycled from Cornwall all the way to Skye, kind of gathering friends along the way and doing all these climbs. Anyway, and I, you know, at the time I was very young. I didn't know this had happened.
Right.
But very sadly, in early 1999, Jamie died in a climbing accident in the Alps.
Oh, right.
And they were trapped by bad weather and spent many, many days trapped high on a mountain in the Alps. And him and his climbing partner and Jamie sadly died, and his climbing partner miraculously survived. His climbing partner is also called Jamie, which is slightly confusing, but we'll come back to him.
Okay.
And he miraculously survived somehow, but he lost both his hands and feet to frostbite. So, you know, permanently changed by this accident.
Absolutely.
You know, losing his great friend Jamie as well.
Yeah.
But as I say, the family, the Fisher family, you know, have been for a long time and still are, you know, close family friends of ours. So Jamie's father, Stu, you know, I'd often see him, you know, probably at least once a year. He'd kind of come and see us in Edinburgh and we'd go on holiday and things together. So in about 2009, I was actually on a sailing holiday and we sailed to the Isle of Skye and I was with Stu Fisher and we were kind of sat in the evening sun underneath. We're in Loch Carusk, so, you know, looking up, you know, at the sun setting on the Coolin Ridge. And Stu's always one for a great story. He's kind of larger than life, kind of Zambian guy. So very good at telling a story. And he started telling me this story about Jamie and his classic rock challenge, that he'd done all of the climbs in classic. Because by this time, I'd got quite into rock climbing myself. You know, I hadn't done it so much, but I'd got into very into it at university. And he was telling me about it because I'd obviously heard of the book. And he was like, yeah, so he, you know, he did all these climbs. Of course, by the time he got to the Coolin, he was like super fit. And he's done it before. So he kind of ran across it and did it in about 5 hours or something, you know, which was probably reasonable. I think the record's quite below that now. But, you know, it was a pretty good time.
It's not a bad time, so, 5 hours.
And I didn't know about it, you know, because I'd been quite young when he'd done it. So. It just kind of put this idea in my head that, you know, that's quite a cool thing to do. You know, I'd quite like to repeat that at some point, you know, because, you know, Jamie had been this, you know, kind of influence on me when I was younger and he'd done this quite cool thing. So, you know, the seed was planted then, 2009.
Right. Okay.
A good few years now. And then, it just kind of sat there for a while. But then end of 2017, you know, I had a bit of a gap. I was between jobs or unemployed, whatever way you want to think of it.
Yeah.
And had some time in the next summer. And I was like, I'll do it. So I just decided I was going to do it and made a plan. And the key thing about it and the thing that Jamie discovered as well is, you know, it was an opportunity to meet up with all your old climbing friends. Because rather than... to get, you know, when you go climbing, you have to have someone to climb with if you don't want to climb soloing. So you need a partner to hold the rope and things.
Well,
so,
I was going to ask you that actually. So you didn't solo most of these routes. You did them with somebody or most of them. Is that right?
I did pretty much all of them with someone else with a rope.
Right. Yes. Okay. That's cool. Yeah.
So, just it was an excuse really to get out climbing with friends. Really, you know, that was the thing. I managed to get people out who I'd not climbed with for years and things, and get them out for a few days and do some of these great climbs. So
when you did it, did you when you say you cycled it? So you set it, presumably you got down to Cornwall. Did you cycle to Cornwall or was that...
I got driven to Cornwall. I was living in Bristol at the time.
Ah, okay, that makes life a bit easier. Okay, fair enough.
I organized to do the first climb. So there's a bit of kind of logistics funniness going on. So I started on the Isle of Lundy because there's a climb on the Isle of Lundy. And Lundy, it's not the National Trust. It's another trust who owns it.
Right.
But it's you can only climb on it at certain times of year on certain climbs. And also it's quite complicated to get to because there's no daily ferry. And it's not a regularly scheduled ferry either. It seems to, it goes on random days of the week. And it's dependent on the tides.
Yeah, what's that climb called on Lundy?
Oh, it's called the Devil's Slide.
Right, I thought I'd heard of that. I couldn't remember the name of it. Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, there was only one day where I could go across to Lundy for the day and have time to do the rock climb.
Right.
Which I think was the 19th of May, 2018. And so that was kind of actually fixed quite a long time in advance. And that's where I was going to start. And the thing is, it makes more sense to start in Land's End and come back via Lundy. But because I could only go on that day,
I
start then. And there was there was other logistics as well, such as a wedding I wanted to go to in the middle in Northumberland. Anyway, these dates were set, and but I went to, I organized to go with my brother and sister who live in Bristol, both rock climb themselves, and of course both had this connection with Jamie Fisher. So I thought it'd be great if the three of us went over to Lundy for the day, did the rock climb, and then I set off cycling from there. So I got driven. We drove with the bike on the roof
to Well, that's fair enough.
Westward Ho, which is where you get the ferry across from. So we went into the climb. Perfect hot summer, sunny day, and and then they drove back to Bristol, and I kind of set off with my ridiculously heavily laden bicycle
Well, that's
over the
that,
hill
that's what I was
over the
gonna.
hills of Bodmin towards Land End to go climbing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So this means that you had to cycle. Did you cycle with camping gear and rock climbing gear, or did you somehow manage to just sort of like stay on people's floors and that sort of thing?
I had all my camping gear, because I was kind of making this up, I kind of was making up the rules as I went along, and I decided that I had to be totally human powered. So for how I would get around, and I wouldn't, apart, I had to get a couple of ferries, of course. I wasn't going to row or kayak across.
No, we'll give you that one.
So the idea is I would move myself around, so to save a bit of weight, and because whenever I was climbing with, if I needed climbing gear, I would be climbing with someone. So everyone I climbed with brought the rope and the gear. So they brought their own rope and equipment, and then we would climb using that. But so I just had to provide. So I would, in terms of climbing equipment, I had my climbing shoes, a harness, a couple of slings and a belay device, and my helmet.
Basically,
And then whoever I was climbing with would kind of bring the rest.
the protection
and
and everything.
And we'd climb using their gear. But I had all my camping gear. I was, most of the time I was camping. Of course, I'd never turned down a kind of bed for the night. So I did end up staying with a few people and a few bunk houses and
I
things.
see.
Kind of people get to know and invite you into things. So yeah, I definitely a lot of good hospitality on the way around as well.
Great. I must
But yeah,
have
there was a lot of camping in roadside kind of ditches as well.
a great. So presumably, I mean, when you did it in 2017, you did it. Is that that's right? Okay.
2018.
Sorry, 2018. Okay. So obviously you had the internet. So presumably an awful lot of this was done. Was it over Facebook and things like that to arrange things? Is that how it worked?
Yes, quite different. Initially via email. So I thought up a big list of people who I thought might be interested, and I'd made up my kind of approximate plan, and I was like, I think I'm going to be in Cornwall around here, I'll be in Wales around here, I'll be in the Peak District around then, and the like these bits of Scotland around then, and those bits around then. And I was like, if you want to get involved, let me know, and when you want to come, and I'll kind of we'll start making a plan. So I love a good spreadsheet. So I've kind of made up this big plan, and just over the kind of few months before, just gradually cajoled people into committing to come, on this kind of premise that, it's a thing, to do it, to be part of this unique trip.
Absolutely.
So if people were kind of dithering, I'd be like, come on, this is a unique opportunity to come and join me on this and do it. So this was probably a bit different, I think, than when Jamie did it, because I think Jamie kind of gathered people along the way. Also, I think he was probably a bit closer to being in uni, and maybe his friends didn't have as many proper jobs. And also it was pre-mobile phone, so he was just doing things from phone boxes, I think, phoning
That
people
must have
along the
been,
way.
you forget the people actually had to operate like that, didn't you?
And also it was kind of organized, you get a phone call a week in advance, and it'd be like, meet at this pub, at the old Dungeon Ghyll in Langdale on this day at this time, and I'll see you then. And and you don't hear from them then, you just got to do it. Whereas now, of course, because I was going to come to it, I did actually end up climbing with Jamie Andrew in the Lake District. So Jamie Andrew, who lost his hands and feet in the same accident, and he was kind of teasing me because I sent him a pin on Google Maps about where to meet me, and he was reminiscing that when he met Jamie to do the same climbs, yeah, it was this, meet at the pub at the old Dungeon Ghyll. rather than being sent this a Google Maps pin. So I felt slightly kind of that I wasn't doing it properly.
Yeah, you're using artificial aid, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
And go on, sorry.
Oh, sorry. So I think that it basically ended up, so Jamie soloed a lot more routes than I did. I think partly because he wanted to, and partly because it was probably harder to logistically get the partners in place.
Yeah. He didn't have much choice. Yeah.
Whereas, I managed to organize to have someone to climb most places. So managed to have a rope most of the time, and I didn't have to do too much soloing.
Yeah. It's always a good thing, I think, personally. Yeah. Very good. And how long did that? Well, no, I was going to ask you, first of all, obviously you kind of had a schedule. So does that mean that there were times, there must have been times you were climbing when it was, when the weather wasn't that great, or you didn't particularly want to climb?
Well, that was going to be the assumption to start with. So in the plan, I'd kind of built in a bit of kind of slack.
Right.
You know, because I was kind of like, oh, I'll, you know, because the climbs are kind of focused around particular areas.
Generally. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I'll be like, oh, I think it would probably take me about this long, but I'll maybe schedule in a few extra days for kind of bad weather. And the idea, and everyone who I kind of asked to come on it, I was like, if it's crap weather, we're still climbing.
Right.
You're going to have to face that. But fortunately, the kind of May, June, July of 2018 was incredibly warm and dry. So, I got incredibly lucky with the weather and hardly had to climb in the rain at all. In fact, I'm pretty sure in England, I didn't really have to climb in the rain. The only time I had particularly bad weather was kind of at the worst time, really. It was in Glencoe, which I definitely saw as the kind of the crux or the most difficult passage was in Glencoe, because those were the most intimidating, difficult climbs. And those are the ones we had to climb in the rain.
Oh, great.
Which was a bit unfortunate.
Which climbs are you talking about there then?
So there's a particular one there which is kind of fills people with dread called the Chasm.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah.
Which is on Buccalette of Moher.
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of halfway between a gorge walk and a rock climb.
Yeah.
And it climbs this kind of cleft up the side of Buccalette of Moher. So it's kind of a series of rock steps going up this kind of semi-dried out kind of stream bed. Of course,
so it can be a stream, can't it? It can be actually.
Yes.
Yeah, it can be.
Yes, but sometimes it disappears underground, and in the spring when it's dry, then the rock does dry out and you can climb it. But anyway, but you ultimately climb up into this kind of cave at the top, which you have to climb out of. Which is very, very rarely dry. And of course, on this day, it wasn't. So we had to kind of climb. And it was the most difficult technical bit of climbing on the whole trip, which I then had to do kind of in the soaking wet. And it's definitely the closest I came from the whole trip to falling off. Of course, I had a rope on, but it was also a classic Scottish belay, which was, less than ideal.
Yes, I know. I know a few of those, yes. So it sounds like classic Scottish weather as well, to be honest, quite honest.
Yes, because the Scottish climbs in the mountains, they're of a much more adventurous nature, than, a lot of the English ones are, but, in Scotland, there's all the routes were big and long. I can't remember what the statistic was, but it was something like a third of the climbs in terms of number were in Scotland, but well over half of the vertical distance climbed was in Scotland.
Is that right? That's interesting.
The size of the routes was just, they were all, probably like well over 100 meters long. And it had the longest one, of course, which is the long climb on Ben Nevis.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's like over it's like 300 and something meters high or something.
Right. Okay.
So, I think it's technically the longest continuous rock climb, not on a sea cliff in the UK.
Wow.
Maybe on the mainland, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, that's big enough. That'll do. Yeah. Right. Okay.
And it finishes right on the summit of Ben Nevis. So you've kind of climbed up the north face of Ben Nevis, which is this kind of epic rock face. And then you pop out on the top and, there's someone who's walked up in flip-flops carrying a Tesco bag or something.
Yeah. I've done quite a lot of routes on Ben Nevis in the winter, so I'm very familiar. I'm very familiar with that feeling.
Well, this was on the Orion Face, which is famed for climbing in winter, and I climbed with a guy called Ez Trezeder up there. And as we, you know, I knew he'd done a lot of climbing there, and I knew, and I was like, oh, Ez is going to know this well. And then he admitted, he was like, I've never actually climbed on here in the summer, and it looks very different. And all of the rocks aren't frozen in place, because in the winter, all of the loose rock is frozen in, whereas in the summer, it's all a bit loose and kind of scary. Yeah, as you're moving around.
Some of the most frightening rock climbing experiences I've ever had have been on the north face of the Ben in the summer, when everything appears to be detachable, including yourself. Yeah. Exactly. I don't like that kind of climbing. I like to sort of be nailed on, you know. So it took you. So how long did the whole project? How long did it take you?
72 days.
Right. So that's pretty good going, really. Well, what did you regard as the more challenging? Was it the cycling, or was it the rock climbing?
Oh, I don't know. I tried to get fit before I started. You know, I did quite a lot of cycling and things, and a bit of climbing, but nothing really prepares you for doing it. So the first week I was just knackered the whole time.
Right.
And then I didn't necessarily notice that I'd got kind of fitter and stronger, but I just noticed that I'd wear out my climbing partners very quickly. So, you know, because I'd, you know, we're trying to do a lot in a few days. So I'd kind of arrive in Wales and kind of start climbing with someone. And, you know, we climb kind of solidly for kind of 3 days doing all these climbs, running around things.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then they'd be like, right, I'm done. I can't keep up anymore. Can't do anymore. And then I'd be like, what do you mean? I've still got another 5 days to go. And they'd kind of drive off home and another person would arrive. And, you know, and then I'd keep going with them. So, and, you know, I was just, you know, by the time I'd kind of got a few weeks in, then I was quite happy doing that. Just that kind of just to do a massive day, you know, a kind of 12, 14 hour day of walking and cycling and climbing, and then you feel knackered. And then you get up the next day and just do it again.
I can remember a few days like that.
Physically, I think I just kind of got fit, and I'd say because the weather was so good, I ended up having quite a bit of kind of few extra days around, it never got too rushed, if that makes sense.
It sounds like you were incredibly lucky with the weather.
Yes, I was.
Which I'm not belittling what you did at all. But I mean, in some ways, it was a kind of memorial climb, I suppose, in a way, for Jamie.
Yes. So I wanted to try and link it back to him, you know, what he did. That was done through a few ways. First of all, when he did it, he raised some money for the John Muir Trust.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which, of course, do a lot of work for kind of managing and protecting wild lands in the UK.
Yeah.
So I had that link as well. You know, I wanted to kind of raise a bit of money and a bit of awareness for them. So I always like to give them a mention for the good work that they do. And also this idea of, you know, meeting up with friends and kind of climbing along the way. And I managed to kind of, you know, meet up and climb with some of the people who'd done it the first time around or knew about it the first time around.
Right.
So,
okay.
As I say, so Jamie Andrew, who was his climbing partner and who was in that same accident in the Alps and lost his hands and feet, he still climbs. You know, he has some special feet that he puts on. So he replaces his kind of walking feet and puts on these feet where he has little kind of rubber feet for climbing. He doesn't use anything on his stumps. He doesn't use any kind of prosthetic. He's just got very kind of adept and dexterous at just using his stump. So he can, you know, he can tie into a climbing harness and things, you know, without any hands, which is amazing. And the first time around in 1997, he had gone and done a big chunk of the Lake District climb for Jamie, because there's a whole bunch of climbs in the Lake District. I think about 17 or something in the Lake District. No, maybe 20.
Right.
And they'd gone around and done them all in this kind of beautiful summer. You know, they'd soloed most of them. Anyway, so I got in touch with Jamie and I said, it would be great, you know, if you came and did some of those climbs again. And yeah, he did. So he came and we climbed some of the classic ones on gable, which is Nape's Needle
Oh,
and
yeah.
Needle Ridge.
Yeah.
So Nape's Needle is a very kind of famous and iconic climb.
Yes.
Some people say it's, you know, the first recorded rock climb in the UK and things, but obviously way back then, no one was really recording things. But
No.
It's quite iconic.
Yes.
And so he came and joined for the day. He came and camped in the little campsite down at Seathwaite. And and we walked up and did this climb with another friend of mine. Yeah, it was just amazing, you know, because he just kind of gets on and just climbs, you know. He finds it harder because obviously, like, not having hands to grip on with, it's all kind of very balancey, but he kind of like fought his way up and sat on top of Nate's Needle. So, you know, I guess I kind of felt it at the time, but kind of thinking back about it, you know, it's quite special, you know, us sat, you know, because it's also one, you know, a lot of things about rock climbing is you climb somewhere and in theory you could have walked there, you know, like we're talking about climbing Ben Nevis, you can climb up the steep side, but you can also walk walk up the back if you want to. But Nape's Needle, you can only sit on top of Nape's Needle if you have climbed it. There's no other way up.
I never thought of that, but yeah, that's right.
So it's one of these rock climbs that you can only get to the top of if you climb there. So it's a great photo, you know, of me and him sat together on top of Nape's Needle, kind of silhouetted against the sun there. So that, you know, it was quite special to be able to do that and have that connection.
Oh, that's amazing.
And another part was really kind of at the end, because I mentioned before Jamie Fisher's his father, Stu Fisher,
mm-hmm.
And he was kind of keen to kind of be involved. He couldn't do any climbing because he's had his own kind of problems with his ankles and things, and so he's not as mobile as he used to be, but he was adamant that he wanted to come to Skye for the finish, because the last climb, well, you can do the climbs in whatever order you wanted, but for me the last climb was going to be a full traverse of the Coolin Ridge, because that's you know, that's one of the classic climbs. It's a bit different from the rest because it's a full traverse. As you know, up there the weather can be fickle.
To get
a good opportunity to do a traverse, because a lot of people do that traverse over 2 days, you know, because it's quite kind of long and technical. I'd been on the ridge before, but I'd never attempted a traverse before, so I was quite nervous about doing it. And that was when the weather broke. Just that week the weather broke, and you know, it rained the day before, it rained the day I arrived on Skye, and you know, there was another few climbs to do. I'd met my friend Josh there, and we got up at I think 5 a.m to run up and do a few rock climbs on the ridge. There was three climbs we had to do, and we got down by 12 o'clock just as the heavens opened, and it absolutely chucked it down for the rest of the day. You know, but we got those three climbs in. So all I had left to do was a traverse of the ridge. But the forecast was just atrocious. And, you know, we were kind of looking at the various forecasts, trying to find one we agreed with. And we spotted a window of about 12 hours the following afternoon.
Okay.
Where the wind was dropping, and it looked like the cloud would lift, because it's quite difficult navigating up there. So you don't want it to be cloudy. Yeah. So it looked like the next afternoon that it was going to be okay. And normally when people do the Coolin Ridge, you know, they set off at, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning, so they can start the ridge at first light at 6 and have all day to do it. But, you know, it absolutely howling with wind and rain all night. We woke up in the morning and, like, people's tents had blown away, and they were, you know, like caught in the barbed wire fences. And we're kind of like, oh, we'll just wait a bit. And we ended up setting off about 9 a.m., which took us to the top of the first hill, Garsven, which is the southern end of the ridge, which is a traditional place to start. So we were sat there at about midday. It was like really cold, bitterly cold winds. The cloud was in. We couldn't see anything. And we were like, oh, we'll just wait. We'll wait. The forecast said it was going to get better. We'll wait. But we were just getting colder and colder because, you know, we didn't have very much stuff with us because we wanted to.
Yeah, yeah, you can't. Yeah, yeah.
They were like, oh, we'll just have to go. So we set off at about 12 o'clock. And the first bit's, because the first bit's quite easy. It's not too hard. And we set off. And the first bit, you know, it's quite windy and we couldn't really see, but then within about an hour, wind dropped, the cloud lifted, and suddenly we could just see the whole ridge kind of laid out in front of us and kind of in these glimpses. And it was like, oh, maybe this is going to work. And the thing is, we still weren't sure when we set off. We weren't sure if we're going to make it to the end. We're like, oh, we'll just see how far we get. We'll see how far we get. We may as well go. I mean, if the weather craps out, then that's okay. You know, at least we tried. And as we got further along, we were just kind of, the weather just kept on improving, and it just became this kind of glorious kind of late summer afternoon, because, you know, we hadn't started until, you know, after lunchtime. And of course, there was no one up there. No one else would be kind of stupid enough to go up there on that day. So there was no kind of queuing or anything on the routes. And, you know, obviously I was kind of pretty fit by then and very confident with my climbing. And my friend Josh was like, he was kind of just having to keep up. And I think just kind of keeping up with my enthusiasm, because if he was kind of nervous or scared at all, you know, I was just kind of like, no, we just got to go. We just got to go. We'll go this way. So we kind of put our rope on in a couple of sections, but we couldn't really afford to because we didn't have time. It was going to get dark. So we weren't running. We were just kind of moving quickly along. So by the time we got kind of halfway across over the Inn Pin, you know, it was about 4 in the afternoon. And we're kind of like,
right,
that was the point when I was like, we're going to do it now. We're going to make it. We've done half the ridge. You know, we've still got 4 or 5 hours of daylight left, or even more. You know, we can make it if we carry on. So we did, and we carried on, and, you know, got to the end of Skyr An Gileadh, you know, I think about 8:30. So it had taken us just over 8 hours to kind of do the traverse, which is, you know, a reasonable time. For first timers. And as I say, we were kind of walking rather than running. And, you know, I hadn't really looked at my phone kind of along the ridge. Because, you know, we've just been kind of going, you know, we just got to get there.
Yes,
and I was like, great, you know, got to the end. It's kind of the end of this kind of big trip. And you're kind of like, you feel kind of elated, but slightly deflated at the same time.
Absolutely,
anyway, I look at my phone, and it's a message from Stu, because I had been in contact with Stu Fisher, and he'd been kind of talking about, he's like, I'm going to try and come up. When are you going to try and do it? And, you know, I've been saying I wasn't sure about the weather and when we managed to do it. Anyway, he'd driven that day from, I'm not sure where he'd started, somewhere. I think he'd been in Edinburgh, actually, visiting friends, and he turned up at the Sligachan pub, which is the pub under the end of the ridge.
Yes.
And I had a message from him saying, I'm in the Slig, you know, are you going to make it down in time for last orders?
Amazing.
So that was just great. So
I take it you did. He did make it down for last orders, did you?
We did make it down. We didn't make it down in time for the kitchen, but he had ordered us some food, which they then kindly reheated for us in the microwave. Because, you know, it was just after 10, I think, by the time we got down.
Wow.
So it was just amazing to kind of do this whole thing, and complete kind of fortuitous, really, that was the moment that Stu managed to make it to Skye and ended up in the Sligachan pub, which is where you go after you finish. You know, it was just the absolute perfect way to kind of finish it, you know, was to meet him at the end and bring everything together. You know, it was my, you know, the trip, this amazing trip, which, you know, I'd done and kind of done with my friends, but also with this connection to Jamie's original trip, which was, you know, 20 years before. So it just all came together.
Brilliant. Amazingly. Ollie, that was fantastic. That was really interesting. Thanks very much for telling me your story. And I think it was a fitting memorial, really, to Jamie. Thanks a lot, Ollie.
Thank you.